I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Fair.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us connected again tonight. How many shows is this? We're pushing 80 since the fall of 2006. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jumble Justice Radio Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and as usual, we want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that memorable trip across 90 different cities and states. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, he does sing that song without lyrics. In other words, printed lyrics. So that is a memory feed for sure. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight. You folks look more nervous this week than you did last week. We caught Mike looking in his hem of his sport jacket to see if he could find an RFID chip. And then, since I've gotten the book Spy Chips in the mail from Amazon this week, and I've started reading it. By the way, I'll have a lot more to say about that. A fascinating read. I see a lot of people fidgeting around looking for RFID chips embedded in their clothing. I think I even saw Harold, our goldfish here, look into one of his gills to see if he's got one. But anyway, that's our subject again for tonight, part two. And ladies and gentlemen, I think you're going to find this fascinating. This subject really excites me, and it tells me about things I simply did not know that are not secret. They're just things that the industry that is pushing this and some government sources just don't think we would be interested. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I've never been. But here is something that is moving in to your life. I like the opening line that Catherine Albrecht and Liz McIntyre have in their book. On page one, it says, imagine a world with no more privacy. And folks, with RFID chips combined with satellite communications, GPS systems, we're just about there. The purpose of our show is the same as it is every week. We like to discuss the news, issues, events, developments in this difficult and inspiring field of criminal justice. That's police, courts, and corrections. We try to take a look at the dedicated professionals who perform that work, and sometimes we get into some ancillary type of topics. This might be one of them tonight, but the criminal justice implications and the Homeland Security and secrecy, intelligence, espionage implications of these RFID chips are just probably unlimited. And thank you. You might see what I mean when you listen to some of the commentators talk tonight about what we're talking about. So anyway, we're glad you're with us. We're on BTR, which is Blog Talk Radio Network. There's now more than 66 30,000 shows archived under 66 different categories on blogtalkradio.com. If you can't find something there that interests you, I suggest you probably need to start over because you're not interested in anything. What is possible with this medium, and I keep trying to get encouraging people to do it, is that any person in the interest group, any organization, any club, clique, whatever, any five people, any two people who are interested in broadcasting their own radio show in streaming audio over the internet worldwide, yes, to an unlimited number of listeners, you can do that more than 14 hours a week, and the cost is what? You got it, Mike. It's absolutely free. Absolutely free, if you can believe that. So get your own show. If you don't like this one, you don't like any others you see, I would find that hard to believe when you look at BTR's list of shows. But anyway, there's a lot going on there, and it's a fantastic medium. And Alan Levy started with it back in the summer of 2006 with his own one show. And now we're up to that many shows. Just incredible. Tonight we're going to do part two on the radio frequency, the RFIDs. It comes by various names depending on who you talk to, but the RFID chips, radio frequency identification chips. And last week we heard co-author Liz McIntyre talk quite a bit about the book, and she is a technical and a investigative writer that joined the first author, Dr. Catherine Albrecht, her doctoral degree from Harvard. And we'll hear tonight Dr. Albrecht talk about the book and what inspired her and some of the things that she's found out. And I can tell you, this woman is without fatigue. Since this book came out in 2005 by one publisher, and Penguin, I think, picked it up the second time in 2006. This book, by the way, is $10.20 on Amazon.com. It is 278 pages with hundreds and hundreds of endnotes, citations. So it is just super researched. And when people talk to her, they will comment on the diligence in this. I just read Bruce Sterling, who's the editor for Wired Magazine, a magazine I love and have looked at for years, and in the hard copy, it's a beautiful laid-out magazine in terms of color and print and shading and all sorts of things, and, of course, interesting stories about technology. But I just read his endorsement of this book, and I tell you, it's hard to find a more promising and laudatory endorsement than what he did. So I'm fascinated by this book, and I'm going to inhale this thing as fast as I can, and you'll be seeing a book review on it on Conservative Justice Digest, and probably here in a few weeks. So that's our subject again tonight. It'll be part two. If you care to listen or comment, you can certainly do that. We'll talk a little bit about the news first, some things going on in criminal justice. Boy, there's a lot of it, so we certainly can't talk about much. But we'll have a few stories and then move on to the RFID subject. But you can call in if you would like. The number's 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And if you can't call in tonight, or you can't even listen to the show, you folks know that for all of it, you can go to the archive within 10 minutes after the show's done, and you can download the whole thing to your own computer, MP3 player, or you can listen to it right on the internet. So fabulous service. Audrey, you have our bond joke for tonight. I took a sneak peek at this one. I really like this one. So, ladies and gentlemen, Audrey England, our technical and spiritual advisor for the show, every week presents a blonde joke. She is a blonde. She is actually from London, England, and she's been a collector of blonde jokes since childhood, has drawers and trunks full of them, and she's pulled out one of her favorite ones tonight. So, Audrey, let's go ahead with this one.
Professor Haley, here is one of my favorite blonde jokes. I know your listeners will like this one. A blonde finds herself in serious trouble. Her business has gone bust, and she's in dire financial straits. She's so desperate that she decides to ask God for help. She begins to pray. God, please help me. I've lost my business, and if I don't get some money, I'm going to lose my house as well. Please let me win the lottery. Lottery night comes, and somebody else wins. She again prays. God, please let me win the lottery. I've lost my business, the house, and I'm going to lose my car as well. Lottery night comes, and she still has no luck. Once again, she prays. My God, why have you forsaken me? I've lost my business, the house, and my car. My children are starving. I don't often ask you for help, and I've always been a good servant to you. Please let me win the lottery just this one time, so I can get my life back in order. Suddenly there is a blinding flash of light as the heavens open. The blonde is overwhelmed by the voice of God, himself. Sweetheart, work with me on this. Buy a ticket.
I think that's level one excellent, Audrey. Thank you. Thank you very much. You have to buy a ticket to win the lottery. That is for sure. All right, folks, on a much more serious note, each week we like to join with the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence and play their public service announcement that's directed toward, I believe, getting the gangbangers, the crooks, and the robbers, and people on the street who carry guns and shoot at others, to lay down their guns and turn them into the police. So we'd like for you to listen very closely to their message. And those of you who are carrying guns tonight that are listening and you are criminals, please do as the Ohio Coalition would want you to do, turn in those firearms.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It certainly is a deadly idea, and thank you very much to Ohio Coalition. And those of you who are listening that are violating the law in that way, you need to take action, be a good citizen, and turn those firearms in. Let's take a look at a couple of news stories here tonight before we get to some of our audio clips. And tonight we're going to go back to some of the old technology, way back to fall of 2006. Kind of technology where we have to move the phone around in front of speakers, but it works. We did it for probably almost a year before Blog Talk Radio allowed us to upload audio segments. And these are segments that, because of format, et cetera, we're not able to upload them. But I think you'll get the message very clearly. Here's a story about a firefighter, not it's public safety, not exactly criminal justice, but the cops did make an arrest. And I'm going to say this is unusual, of course, in the firefighting occupation. What a job to have. I've always admired firefighters. If you gave me a choice, I'd much rather look for a burglar in a dark building who may be armed as opposed to going into a flaming building and, doing firefighting for sure. But this is about a Polish firefighter, and he's accused of going on an arson spree in order to notch up enough overtime to buy his girlfriend a present. Well, he's now going to be serving 10 years in jail. The guy's only 18 years old, and he set a fire in a barn in Studzianski and then went on to set another local fire where he would earn overtime money each time he'd get called out on these firefights. Police said he then torched two other barns over the next week, and that was an attempt to get even more money. But he was finally caught when one of the local farmers saw him setting fire to another barn. The officer there said he's been charged with arson and endangering public safety, I should say. But the police spokesman said he just wanted to get enough money to buy his girlfriend a present, a good present. Well, I don't think that's the way to do it. And I think 10 years in prison, I don't know how the Polish do in terms of serving your full sentence, but I imagine they're not quite as stringent, probably even as we are. This is another story. It's kind of interesting. I love Google, and I've used Google in every capacity you probably can, and the maps and the reader and the documents and the notes and all that business. It's a fascinating technology. It does do free university email communication and other services. And we saw last week in a news story that they're organizing the intelligence files for the CIA. Well, take it one step farther. You've probably used the Google satellite before, Google Earth, and you've clicked on the satellite. You can go down any place in the United States, and in some cities and places, you can actually go even closer, down as far as it'll go, and then you can click on Google Street View in a lot of places. Well, here's a couple in Pittsburgh that are claiming that their privacy was invaded by Google Street View mapping. And when you look at this particular map, the article I have, the search giant has removed images of this family's home. But when you look at these photos, it not only shows their house, it shows that Google had to be up in their driveway, and then there's a person across the street where they did the same thing, and it looks like Google has been trespassing. So they've been trespassing on private property in order to get that that Google view of their house. But that's not, you know, if you stop and think about it, that's not something that a lot of homeowners would like, because some people with the worst kind of interest could be using Google Street View to look at their house to see things to steal, et cetera, without even having to drive out to the scene. So that's kind of interesting, but Google's involved in all sorts of things. And this just came out on April 6th, so we couldn't have talked about it last week, but you have to love San Francisco. A lot of things go on there. It's a beautiful city and loaded with wonderful people, but one of the strange ideas they have that I don't agree with was this idea of being a sanctuary city for illegal immigrants. They've been that since 1989, and it's kind of interesting. Not only now are they a sanctuary city, but they're spending a big bundle of money now to go into a advertising campaign so they can advertise to all the illegal immigrants about the kind of things that they can get, public services, including schools, health clinics. Of course, you know they're going to get welfare services, whatever. Safe access to all the public services without any threat of ever being turned in by some government authority or certainly the police. So I think what's going to happen, some of the commentators of this news story have actually said that in the article, not the comments at the bottom, but they said, you know, this is going to pay off or not pay off for San Francisco in just a few years, because they think what's going to happen, some other cities are going to benefit because they're going to leave those California cities or Oregon cities or wherever, and they're going to move into San Francisco where they know it's a wide open door and free services available for them. I think there has to be some logical end or conclusion to all this. I don't know how many illegal immigrants San Francisco could sustain at one time, but it sounds like they're going to be getting an increase here pretty quick. I thought this was a real interesting story, kind of a quick one, but there's a boy 11 years old who was sitting in a school bus when his school bus driver, and I forget how many young, 27 students were on the bus, and he's 11 years old. The bus driver fills up the tank for the bus, or fills it up partway anyway. Then he leaves the motor running with the kids sitting in the bus, and he takes off and goes in the restroom. The bus starts rolling and rolls down a hill, and this bus is moving toward a tractor trailer coming at him. This young man, very interesting man, David Murphy, said he worried after he might get in trouble for jumping into the driver's seat, but he jumped into the driver's seat, steered the bus clear of the oncoming tractor trailer truck, and then aimed for a pillar. It was like the last one on this downhill thing, because he saw the farther he went down, he says, there was nothing good down there. So it could have ended in a tragedy. But he bumped into that rail or that girder, and it actually stopped the bus. So the city, of course, is and his school are treating him like a hero. Certainly is. Here's another one on the corrections side. I love the field of corrections. I'm still trying to understand it, but I think it takes it's a lifelong pursuit. The Ohio Supreme Court this past Wednesday overturned the death sentence of a man who killed three people. They said 7-0. They reversed a lower court ruling that the man Clifton White, 35, formerly of Akron, was not mentally retarded, despite the testimony of psychologists hired by the state and the defense team, who said that their diagnosis of mental retardation was not a close call. The justices based their decision on the U.S. Supreme Court case. Most of you know about that, C.J. Field, that's Atkins versus Virginia, which says you can't execute somebody that has mental retardation. And what they look at is both an IQ score. His was 52 on whatever type of IQ test he took. And they also, they look at his adaptive abilities, such as communication, self-care, social skills, and all that, and they said that those skills were equivalent to an 11-year-old. Now, people counter that, and other people in the county say that that's kind of odd, because he does do certain things. One of his neighbors said that he was not mentally retarded, and she based that on the testimony of Heather Kowitz, who said that he worked, rented an apartment, bought a truck, and helped her when she bought a car. Then another couple said that he could cook, he could drive, and he could play the video game Mortal Kombat well enough that he would win at least half of the time. But the Supreme Court overturned that, and now he's just going to be doing 31 years to life, and everyone knows in Ohio that's not going to be life. The people that got life in prison that murdered a friend of mine, he was out in 14 years. Anyway, kind of an interesting story about the death sentence. Let's move on to the RFID chip story tonight. What I'm going to do, I'm going to play a couple segments from National Public Radio. So bear with me as we move around here with the sound equipment just a little bit. And it's going to be sort of a setup for the longer interview with Dr. Catherine Albrecht, who's the first author of the book Spy Chips. So the first thing we're listening to tonight is a little discussion of a privacy group calling for controls on these smart cards, and you'll see what that's all about here in just a second. So bear with me. Just about located. When you finally hear this, you might have to turn on your speaker when you replay it or something, or turn it up a little bit, but normally this has worked out very well. So here we go with the first clip.
The NPR shop invites you to experience the new world of HD radio. All you need is a digital HD radio, available at npr.org/shop. Tiny radio wave generating computer chips called RFID tags are in lots of things, car keys, library books, now even the new U.S. passport. RFID stands for radio frequency identification, and as the tags move into ID documents, privacy groups are crying foul, and politicians in California are trying to rein in the technology. NPR's Martin Kosky reports. Every morning, I wave a white plastic card in the air to unlock the door to my office. Clearly, there's a radio tag in there, so I visited the offices of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, a privacy group in San Francisco, to find out exactly what my key card has been saying about me.
Where is it again?
Try the other pocket. Berkeley graduate student David Molnar runs a radio tag reader along the outside of my pants. The reader is about the size of a mouse, and it's easily purchased on the Internet.
And lower. There it is, 23:260.
The number pops up on Molnar's computer. Every time any tag reader shoots radio waves at my pocket, this is what my wallet says in reply, 23:60. Give or take a digit.
So if you bumped against me in the bus, just freeze it. It's not to get my number.
That's correct.
That number gives Molnar the password to my door, and using another device, he could beep himself in. A similar demonstration at the California State Capitol this summer helped to galvanize legislator support for a bill banning surreptitious radio tag copying. The bill is now being considered for enactment by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. But the legislation goes beyond mere key card security.
Imagine, if you will, that we had RFID technology embedded in our driver's licenses.
Joe Tumidian is a state senator from Silicon Valley and the bill's chief sponsor.
2,500 people go to an anti-war rally at the university. One sets up a reader at the side of the door without anyone's knowledge or consent. An hour and a half later, they've got a list of 2,500 people who attended a perfectly lawful rally. And if they match that to the database, they have all the personal information they need as well.
The tags are not in driver's licenses, not yet. But Congress is leaning on states to improve the security of picture IDs, and radio tags are one way of doing that. If that happens, the Midian's bill requires, among other things, that Californians are given the means to physically turn off ID cards that transmit personal information.
Industry lobbyist Kathleen Carroll says the legislation is overkill.
This bill is trying to address a problem that doesn't exist.
Carroll says her company, HID Global, doesn't know of a single case of surreptitious skimming of radio tag IDs in the real world. She says HID accepts the need for some kind of on-off switch for ID cards, but it does not like other parts of Chmidian's bill, especially a provision requiring that the public be notified of the locations of the radio tag readers.
Because what you're doing, if you post where all the access control readers are, you're also letting criminals and terrorists potentially know where the readers are. Also, you're letting them know where the readers are not.
But the prospect of a world full of hidden radio tag readers has some people spooked. You can now buy wallets and passport covers that are lined with metal, which blocks the radio signals, and hackers have posted instructions for how to fry the radio tags using a disposable camera with a hot-wired flashbulb. Gaetano Borriello says he understands the urge to kill radio tags, but he says these methods are futile.
We have to worry about every little tag and every little object. Boy, you know, that's not going to be a pretty life.
Borriello researches radio tags at the University of Washington. He's in the process of installing tag readers all over his building in order to simulate what he calls the radio tag ecosystem of the future.
Let's not let it go the way it happened with the web, where it kind of the web happened and then we worried about the privacy stuff. Can we do this a little bit ahead of time? And maybe we're a little bit more prepared when it really hits on a mass scale.
Borriello is neither for nor against radio tags. He simply thinks they're inevitable, and we may soon be leaving tracks around the real world the same way we leave tracks around the Internet. The question, he says, will be who gets to see those tracks. Martin Toski, NPR News, Seattle.
Very interesting. You could imagine something like a big university bookstore where they're selling sweatshirts and hoods and all sorts of things, and you stick an RFID in there and the student pays for it with a credit card or maybe even a university sponsored type of card, and they don't know that they're in the RFID system, and you could virtually track that student anywhere they went. Just one little implication for something like this. And you know, what can be done usually ends up being done. So hold on a second. We're going to save this other clip. This was from 2006, the little NPR story. And now we're going to jump ahead to January 2008, where California finally passed a law about this. Here we go.
Support for NPR comes from MGM and United Artists, presenting Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford. Available on DVD April 8th.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick with a story that sounds like science fiction, or maybe just like California. A new law here bans employers from forcing workers to get ARFID implants. ARFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification Devices. These are tiny little gizmos that can be embedded under your skin. Here's NPR's Mandalit Del Parca.
You heard right. Radio frequency ID tags with mini antennas implanted in your body. If this sounds like something out of a movie, that's because it is.
An informant.
In one scene of the latest James Bond caper, Casino Royale, Agent 007 sticks out his arm to get zapped by what resembles a high-tech staple gun.
Ow.
A tiny device gets implanted under his rib. It's encoded with all sorts of identifying information and an antenna that can be read by a scanner back at headquarters.
So you can keep an eye on me?
Yeah. And why about keeping track? Well, now where you are. Now, most people don't have a boss like James Bond, who orders their workers to get chips, and State Senator Joe Chmidian wants to make sure no one in California does. With the backing of such disparate groups as the ACLU, the EPA, and gun owners, he wrote the law outlawing mandatory RFID implants.
I know to a lot of folks this sounds like something out of a science fiction or fantasy movie, but the fact of the matter is it's very real and it's very current.
The Midian says some people have already agreed to implant RFID devices, but his law addresses those who do not volunteer.
The forced tagging of individuals is really something we can't condone. It's the ultimate invasion of personal privacy.
The Food and Drug Administration has already approved the use of the subdermal RFID devices to allow a person's medical history to be read. A company in Florida that makes them, Verichip, reports that 2,000 people have had tags implanted, but requiring employees to have them is not a common practice, says RFID industry advocate Dan Mullen.
I don't think there's a big influx of employers requiring it. In terms of implanting RFID, we see that as a fairly voluntary path. I know of probably 200 people in the whole United States have had a tag implanted for mainly in medical cases. You know, families have consented and Alzheimer's patients have had them. That's the main one I'm aware of.
Mullen is president of AIM Global, an association for automatic identification and mobility companies. He points out that RFID technology has been used since the 1940s to be able to track airport baggage, freeway traffic, and products.
I'm not aware of people forcing anybody to get an implantable RFID. So it doesn't seem like it's a trend or something that the state's citizens need to be protected against.
Still, a video surveillance company in Cincinnati raised some eyebrows in 2006 when it injected two of its secure data center workers with glass-encapsulated RFID chips. The Attorney General of Mexico and his staff members also reportedly got implanted with RFID chips to allow them into high-security areas.
I'm not hostile to the use of RFID technology. I think it's a minor miracle, and it's been on the scene for 60 years since World War II, but I think you have to be smart about how you use it.
Senator Simidian says despite the benefits of the technology, he worries that RFID information could easily be hacked into.
Absent any protections, it's available to broadcast your personal information at any time without your knowledge.
RFID companies say the type of information encrypted into implants is very limited, and there are far easier ways of hacking into people's personal information. Still, to prevent future problems, California now joins Wisconsin and North Dakota in outlawing forced RFID implants. Around the world, others are lobbying for similar legislation, organized on the Internet as groups called antichips.com and wethepeoplewillnotbechips.com. Manda Michel Barco, NPR News.
Okay, one of the things that you're going to hear Catherine Albrecht, the first author of the book Spy Chips, 2006, talk about is some of these things that these folks have said doesn't exist. She, in fact, has found does exist, and she's the world's number one authority probably on this subject right now, and travels throughout the world and speaks about it, and she sees this as sort of a missionary work in terms of letting people know about what Big Brother and Big Shopkeeper both are trying to do, sometimes probably in conjunction, in terms of collecting information about us and knowing where we are. I mean, it's not something going to happen. It's something going on, and she has the documentation for it. So here we go with an interview with Catherine Albrecht, and Dr. Catherine Albrecht. I'm going to move the slide up and stop it and move it forward here to skip some of the things on the recorded radio program. So bear with me on that. But here we go with Catherine Albrecht.
Our guest has indeed called in. Dr. Catherine Albrecht has been a guest on this program. She is a graduate from Harvard University. Whoa! And she knows what she's talking about. She's been a guest on the program numerous times. Her website is Casting the Consumers Against Supermarket Piracy, Invasion, and Nuremberg. Numbering, excuse me. Was that a Freudian slip? And also RFID. Their website is called spychips.com. A lot has happened since we've had Dr. Albrecht on the program. Welcome back to the Power Hour. How are you doing, girl?
Dave. It's a pleasure to be on. Things are going great.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, give us a quick update. What's been going on with Liz and Catherine all this time?
Well, let's see. Of course, Liz is my psychic co-author. That's Liz McIntyre.
She right.
and I have been diligently following the RFID industry as we've been doing since 2003. I've actually got started on this back in 2002, kind of keep an eye on these companies that want to put tiny RFID spy chips into consumer products. The good news is that we're seeing legislation being introduced around the country that would require labeling, and that's something that we've been pushing for several years now, that would essentially say if you're trying to put an RFID tracking device in a shoe or a razor product or some of the many things that we've seen them hitting it
mm-hmm.
without telling the consumer about it. And we're particularly excited. We've got some legislation that just got introduced up in the state of Washington. We've got lawmakers in other states drafting legislation that would essentially require companies to put some form of labeling on products containing RFID tags. So we think that's great news.
Well, we're hearing about this more and more now in the mainstream. Of course, mm-hmm. the spin that they're putting on it is completely different than the spin, if you will, that you're putting on it. But obviously, you're not spinning. It's just basically reporting the technology, what its purpose is, and what it could be used for. But the mainstream media is not telling you that. They're basically giving you a sugar-coated sell on this product. Can you give us an example of how this is working?
Well, you know, it's interesting, actually, Dave. The industry has been trying, and they've hired lobbyists for big bucks to fly around and fight this legislation and make some, I think, fairly outlandish claims about the technology. I remember one particularly in my home state of New Hampshire. A lobbyist flew out here and was talking, didn't realize that I was in the room or that anyone who knew anything about RFID was in the room, was talking to some legislators who weren't familiar with the technology. And somebody said, well, I've heard that you can put an RFID tag into clothing. And, of course, as anybody who's followed my work for the last couple of years knows, we actually photograph pictures of tiny RFID tags that were woven into the labels of Calvin Klein shirts and sweaters, literally just woven right into that little package with Calvin Klein that goes in the neck of the sweater. And, you know, so these things can be very small. The antennas of them can be made out of conductive fabric and woven into clothing. Anyway, this gentleman actually had the nerve to hold up a big RFID tag. I'm talking this thing was probably 4 inches by 6 inches, rectangular, big thing.
Mm-hmm.
He holds it up to the lawmakers who didn't know really any better, and he said, oh, give me a break. Do you think I could hide this RFID tag in your shirt?
Oh, my
And they
God.
All sort of nodded and said, oh, we understand. And then this man had the nerve to say, you know, the privacy activists make a lot of outlandish claims about the technology, but of course they can't say, you know, you just can't do that. Well, I'll tell you, when he finished his testimony and turned around and saw that I had come into the room and that my name was on the list of speakers, he turned 27 shades of red and then he turned pale. And when I got up, I was able to actually hold up a little vial of tiny RFID tags where 150 of them fit into a tiny vial of water and they look like the river silt at the bottom. I mean, these things are so incredibly small.
Mm-hmm.
They have them down to the size. Well, I have one actually stuck on a piece of tape that I've placed on my monitor just to remind me whenever this topic comes up, and I cannot see it. I literally cannot see it unless I get really close and shine a flashlight on it. That's how small they are. So the industry has really been, I think they're the ones making the outlandish claims.
Well, you know, what's amazing.
Technology. Yeah.
What's amazing is about, 7 or 8 years ago, I remember that we had gotten a copy of the USA Today newspaper, and on the front page, they were talking about this nanotechnology. They had a picture of what they said was an electric guitar, a functioning electric guitar. They had taken a picture of with an electron microscope or something like that. They said this guitar was the width of a human hair. Now, if they can make an electric guitar, first that shows they've got way too much time on their hands, but if they can make an electric guitar the width of a human hair, why wouldn't they be able to make a little chip like that that's going to send out data?
Isn't that interesting? Wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
wow.
This is just crazy. Just crazy.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that one. Well, of course, the big story this last week is the big spy versus spy mystery with our Canadian neighbors up to the north. I don't know if you've heard about this one.
Go
this
for it.
Where, yeah, there was a report issued by the Defense Department here in the U.S., and in this 33-page report, on page 32, was a little item buried towards the end that talked about, well, the whole report was about security risks faced by defense contractors working both in the U.S. and overseas, about how foreign governments are trying to get a hold of American defense secrets and trying to get their hands on blueprints and schematics for import-controlled and export-controlled technologies that they can't supply to the U.S. Anyway, buried on page 32 of this report was a little story about three American contractors. They said within the last 6 months, three American contractors had actually found RFID tags hidden inside of hollowed-out Canadian coins. Presumably, now there was just a paragraph, and I spoke to an AP reporter and to some other people who were investigating this, who actually contacted both the Defense Departments of Canada and the U.S., and the Canadian ones, but they had no idea what was going on. The U.S. ones confirmed the story. They actually said, yes, this indeed did happen, that there were three contractors who found these RFID coins on their person, and that they had been fitted with RFID tracking devices.
And they were in coins, right?
They're in coins. Now, Canadian coins, they have a $1 and a $2 Canadian coin that are actually fairly large. They call them, I think, loonies and toonies. And these coins are actually big enough that if you could hollow one out, you actually could fit a sizable amount of microelectronics inside of one. The plot thickened, though, because after the story came out early last week, and there was an AP story out on Wednesday, there was a follow-up story on Friday that says that now the U.S. government is retracting its story.
Really?
This is a story that has been confirmed, that's been written up in this declassified report for defense contractors, and now they're saying, no, never mind. Look the other way. We don't want you knowing about this. We say it didn't happen.
Well,
so,
is that story by chance on either one of your websites?
I'm not sure. I think Liz was going to put it up on our blog at spytips.com. I'm not sure if it's made its way up there yet. But the original story was in the Toronto Star. And if you do a search in Google for anything having to do with RFID in Canada, if there were probably 350 news outlets that picked up that AP story. So it definitely made its way through the internet. A lot of people heard about it. What people don't realize, though, is that now if there was just one story about the retraction, which I just thought was fascinating.
Well,
I was in the Canadian press. Jim Blonskill wrote a story saying, "It seems there's no danger of your search and spying on you after all. The U.S. government defense agency has suddenly retracted its claim that Canadian coins containing tiny transmitters were planted on at least three American contractors who visited Canada." So, to me, this whole story is just riveting because, as you know from having read our book, Spy Tips, we actually opened one of the chapters talking about Avril Karaman, who actually was a high-ranking American security person in the government, and he was given a plaque by Russian schoolchildren that he hung on his wall back in the 1950s. And that, to the best of our knowledge, was the first covert application of RFID to spy on someone. And they were actually able to activate this plaque that sat right in the center of the camp's office where he had private meetings, and activate it from a truck that they could drive down the street outside, beam radio waves at it, and be able to listen to everything that happened in his office.
Wow.
So we know this has a long and illustrious history as spying technology. That's the name of our book, Spy Tips. And now we're beginning to see that there really is, or potentially is, the State Department or the Defense Department, there potentially is a very real risk of this stuff being slipped into your pocket, into your pocket chain. And even if you're not worried about the risk of spying from the actual spies,
mm-hmm.
as defense contractors would have to be, we also had a report come out just about a month ago in the New York Times that the credit cards, you know, those contactless credit cards that they're encouraging people to
The ones you just sort of wave at the gas pump. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, those credit cards, they found out that there's no encryption and no security whatsoever on
mm-hmm.
the vast majority of them. 20 million of them have been issued to Americans. And it is possible for anybody with access to a Visa or MasterCard reader device to come within a couple of feet of you and skim that information right through your credit card or right through your wallet.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is just amazing. You know, we talked about this a few weeks back, and hopefully we can, you know, steer people away from these wireless credit cards because, you know, people are going to get ripped off big time. And I think the whole issue here, and I think you'll agree, is that Big Brother wants to control and watch every move that every human being makes.
No question.
And one of the things, I don't know, have you heard about the story that's been percolating up there in Connecticut, in your neck of the woods? Governor Jody Bell was having her inaugural parade and there was somebody there that was simply taking pictures. Apparently, this guy was an activist, a member of the Libertarian Party, and his name was on a quote-unquote enemies list. And after he'd taken the pictures of Governor Jody Rell, she was already half a mile down the road, all of a sudden the police came and tackled this guy, beat him up, and I guess hauled him off to the Pokey or something like that, said that he was on some sort of an enemies list. He hadn't done anything except for take a picture. I didn't hear about this.
So now at this point, we're not even allowed to take pictures.
Well, apparently not. If you're on some sort of a list, it doesn't make any difference whether you take the pictures or not. You know, you come within, you know, a striking distance of an elected official, and they know about it, well, then, you're in trouble, as they say.
Well, and of course, the problem is no one has access to these lists, and there's no way to find out if you're on one or not, which is some of us, you know, so you run up against area like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is the whole problem. I think people are starting to recognize this, and some folks are starting to take action, and hopefully our guest scheduled for the next hour will be able do you know if he's going to be joining us, Joyce?
No, he's not.
Oh, he's not. Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. We had a
story. Catherine's
going to
tell us about that story.
Oh, okay. Good deal. Yeah, well, we'll be getting into that in the next hour, and of course, we're talking about, shall we just say some activists with some deep pockets are involved in some litigation trying to stop this Orwellian activity. We can get into that a little bit more. But now your book, I want to get back to your book that you and Liz McIntyre put together, the Spy Chips book, is so important. It's somewhat of a landmark, and you've been doing, I think we had you on, it's got to be 3 or 4 years ago at least when you first came out with it. I think we had you on before the book even came out, didn't we?
Oh, absolutely, yes, several years before.
Okay.
Doing the research.
All right, yeah, that's right. But the point here is that since that time, my goodness, you have been one busy girl. You've been on television, you've been on radio shows, and of course the book has gained a certain level of recognition. What has happened since that book has come out, and how has your life changed?
Well, it's one of the things that I like about my work is it's one of the few areas within the freedom and privacy movement where we've actually seen some pretty major successes. And I know that, at this point in time, many Americans are aware of RFID. I don't think that would be the case if we hadn't written the book, if I hadn't done at this point it's over 2,000 media interviews that I've done.
Absolutely.
CNN and CBS and ABC, you name it, have all been sort of forced to talk about this RFID issue because it has actually gotten kind of a high profile because of many of the trials that we helped uncover. But the reason that I'm so excited about the work that I do is because it's a place where we've managed to find a leverage point to sort of slow something down. I don't know if we're going to be able to actually stop it. I'm going to need the help of all your listeners and everybody across the country if we're actually going to sort of stop the risk. But we have put the whole agenda on hold. And back in 2002, 2000, sort of in that early 2002, 2003 era, when I first discovered RFID, I went to some of the meetings, and we detailed these meetings in the book project. I went to some of these meetings where these major corporations, I'm talking some of the biggest companies on the globe, Walmart, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, Kimberly-Clark, International Paper, you name it, Kraft, Nestle, they were all in on this. And they were saying things like, won't it be great when a woman every time the consumer takes the lid off the suitcase in their own bathroom? So there was really a plan afoot back in 2002 to begin rolling this stuff out and to begin placing RFID tags on individual consumer items. And when we learned about that, we said, my gosh, we need to get up on the rafters, up on the rooftops, and shout this out to everybody and caution people. And that's how we launched into our boycott. We have a boycott boycott against Gillette up at boycottgillette.com, where we exposed how they were taking pictures of people. We did a boycott against Benetton, the Italian clothing manufacturer, who put 15 million of these bags into women's clothing as far back as early 2000.
Yeah, I remember we talked about that, the marriage between Walmart and Gillette, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got all these major companies who had all of these big plans, and the good news is that when you shine the light on this information, when people began to hear about it, when it began to get media coverage, when these companies began to get outraged letters from consumers from our boycott site, they took their tail between their legs. I mean, they were like the proverbial cockroach that scutters back under the rock with the light.
Mm-hmm.
They really retracted and re-strategized and repositioned their plan. So what we're seeing now is in the last couple of years, RFID has gained I see some pretty vast strides on the supply chain side, meaning things that go on crates and vessels that are traveling across the sea and across the land, but not on individual consumer products, because the companies, and you'll notice if you go to any of their conferences or you read on their website, they're scared to death of the public. They're scared to death of consumers having a backlash against the first company that sticks its neck out.
Well, as they say, as they say, watch the roaches take flight when you turn on the light. We got a break coming up here. I just want to mention your two websites, spychips.com and nocards.org, are most important. And very quickly, Dr. Albrecht, do you have a telephone number in case people don't have the internet? How can they call to order a copy of your book?
Well, they can reach us at 877-287-5854. And, of course, I have two videos out also with End Time Ministries, and they can be reached at 1-800-END-TIME, E-N-D-T-I-M-E. And those videos are called On the Brink of the Mark, which deals with
We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
During the last 50 years, hundreds of thousands of military personnel have
gone for strong, hard jobs. Tomorrow's going to be a big difference in you that we need to get.
No, they're from Freedom to Fashion.
Yeah,
right?
With
Aaron Russo.
Yeah, with Catherine Albrecht in that. So definitely get those two from the Power Hour. Call 877-817.
If I'm driving a car, I mean, how many years back in the models do I have to go before I don't have that?
Well, actually, in the cars, if there's something in a car that you wouldn't know about, that then you'd probably be looking at something in your tires or potentially down the road in your license plate. But what I was referring to was the toll transponders, the ones that allow people who live in areas with toll roads on their freeways to get through without stopping.
Easy tag.
It goes by a whole bunch of different names depending on where you are in the country. But that device, which millions of people have unthinkingly just strapped right onto their windshield, is capable of beaming out unique identification and allowing you to be monitored and tracked pretty much any place the government decides to place a reader device.
Well, you know, the other thing that scares me, Dr. Albrecht, is the fact that, you know, for instance, Chevy now has this OnStar system. And, of course, they sell it to you saying, well, if you ever lock your keys in the car, or if you ever get locked out, you just simply call us up and we'll be able to get that car open for you right now. And we could even call for help if your car breaks down. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So you pay all this money for a subscription to this thing. But what they don't tell you is that if they can start your car without your, you know, without your key, well, guess what? They could stop your car without your key. I mean, if they can lock you in, unlock you, you know, they could probably lock you out as well. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and in fact, there was a very interesting story a couple of years back where law enforcement officials...
I tell you what, hold on to that, because I know I want to hear about this. Well, we have our top of the hour break, 1 minute and 10 seconds. We're talking with Dr. Catherine Albrecht, a stellar...
You can establish voice communication because those devices include a microphone and a speaker. So if you activate them, you're able to actually say, you know, I'm in a snowdrift, come and tell me out.
Exactly.
We've all heard those frantic, supposedly real conversations that have occurred. You know, I got an accident. Well, don't worry, ma'am, we'll be right there. Well, the law enforcement officials were actually able to tap into that ability and use the OnStar, or I don't know if it was a competitor, if it was OnStar itself, but use that type of system as a bug to eavesdrop on people in their cars. Turned on the microphone.
Isn't that special?
And we're able to listen to the conversation between the driver and the passenger in moving vehicles. Now, that was horrifying to me, and it really underscored the idea that if you adopt willingly something that can be used to spy on you, you have to realize that there are people out there who will want to use the technology for exactly that purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
If you put a microphone in your car that's capable of communicating with satellites, you know, don't be surprised if down the road you find out somebody hacked into the system illegally, somebody, you know, tuned into the system out of sheer curiosity, or that the government tuned into the system because they wanted to keep those accounts.
Let me ask you, this one particular issue about this listening in, this microphone issue, because I've seen the commercial, I've heard the commercial on the radio where people are talking to the operator at the OnStar communication center. My question is, are they communicating via satellite transmissions, or is this a cell phone connection that makes that?
Well,
makes
I know that the GPS portion of the OnStar system is using satellites.
Yeah.
I have not done the research into how the technology works to actually do this, the actual communication. I'm guessing that that would use the cell phone system simply because it would be a lot easier to do that.
Yeah, I would think so. Then, you know, it just, if it is by satellite, then that means that there's a whole new system out there. I mean, I know that there are satellite phones that people use to communicate, which bypasses the cellular system that goes directly to satellites. I mean, that's what a lot of the CNN reporters are using these days. But I was just curious to find out if these OnStar things were doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's one I haven't looked into, but I'm sure a little poking around would probably reveal the answer.
Okay. All right, well, we're going to take our break, and when we get back from this 5-minute break, I do want to open up a successful program designed for people that...
...this information as long as they're allowed to continue their broadcast.
Yeah, buddy.
Those guys.
Oh, they're upset. They are upset today. We've got Dr. Catherine Albrecht joining us once again. She is no stranger to the Power Hour broadcast, and we've been talking to her for, how long has it been now, Catherine? About 5 years we've been screaming about.
5 years. Yeah, I'll tell you, you and Joyce were among the first people to really clear in and figure out what was going on with this technology. So I owe you a huge debt of gratitude.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, we owe you a huge debt of gratitude because of your research and your effort and your amazing tenacity at getting this information out and this topic out into the eyes, ears, and minds of the American people.
Yeah, you and Liz McIntyre, we thank you so very much.
Absolutely. All right, now we are now involved in hour number three of today's broadcast, and I was hoping that we might be able to open up the topic of John Gilmore. Can you give us a little bit of a background on what Mr. Gilmore, who he is, what he's doing, and why it's important?
Well, John Gilmore is actually one of my personal heroes. I just love this guy. He was part of the very early dot-com computer boom when he was one of the founding members of Sun Microsystems. You may know them as the big computer manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's I believe he's no longer affiliated with Sun, but he made a fortune doing that and stock options and other things. And he has since become one of these sort of benevolent, good people out there who is taking his money and using it to fight the good fight to keep the rest of us free and safe. So he has been active in all sorts of corners of the privacy movement, most importantly, from where I sit, in founding the Electronic Frontier Foundation, actually putting seed money down to start one of our sister organizations that's done tremendously good work over the years. They're based out of San Francisco. And they have issued court challenges. They've been involved. They were the people, you may recall a couple of years back, who found the dots on the printers. It actually
we're
printing tiny little yellow dots that are almost microscopic that can be actually pieced back together and form a unique code for each printer, which is what the government was using to identify who had printed out particular flyers or letters.
Oh, yeah.
That was a very juicy story. Well, that came out of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they've got a team of lawyers and researchers, and all of this was funded and founded and got off the ground because of the work of John Gilmore.
I remember hearing about that. Was the late 90s, wasn't it? About 1998?
That was actually more recently. I would say that was probably within the last 2 years of that story.
Oh, really? Okay, I was thinking about something else. That's okay.
Their website is at EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation.org, and you can actually even go on there and get a list of the printers that are doing this, that are under certain light, you shine the light a certain way, and you can see these little tiny dots, and depending on their placement, it identifies your specific HP or ScanJet or Lexmark, whatever brand of printer that you're using. Epson, I think, was in on that. Virtually all of the major printer manufacturers. So anyway, we have John Gilmore to thank for informing us about that information. So that was great. But the other thing he's done is he's really taken on a role in the travel privacy arena. So he is...
I think we'll put off that story there about John Gilmore, but it's certainly an interesting one. I would encourage you, I may comment a little bit about this on next week's show, but we've already done two shows, but certainly get the book Spy Chips. Go to spychips.com, go to EFF.org, and take a look at that, and also look at the Caspian site which is the personal one of Catherine Albrecht. But I'm not through with this book, so it's difficult to comment on one. But by next week, I think I'll have this thing inhaled. And this gets just more and more fascinating if we would have had a chance to listen to Albrecht finish this particular interview. But anyway, we're going to sign off here for the night. And Audrey, she's given us the signal. It's time to go, so I guess we better take off. We'll see you next time. We'll be seeing each other again, I'm sure.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Blog Talk Radio.